Hi, this is Jane Slavin, and you're listening to the Sirens of Audio.
You are now traveling through time and space.
Hey, audiophiles, you're listening to the Sirens of Audio. My name's Dwayne and...
My name is Philip. G'day, everyone.
We've got a brand new title sequence. Thought it was time for a change, Philip, so thought I'd freshen that up. What do you think of the new titles?
I love a bit of retro, and I love it when all the spelling works out properly as well. So well done, Dwayne.
Yeah. Yeah, we worked that out. It's good to get someone else's eye cast over it, isn't it? But, you know, that piece of music that I'm using for the theme now, I actually found that because I actually specifically went looking on the internet for a Doctor Who cover of the theme done in the style of musical theatre. I was trying to find something specifically for you.
If there was only tap dancing, Dwayne, it would have been perfect.
Really?
No. Oh. Definitely not.
Okay. Because I was going to say, I found... No, I didn't find any tap dancing, but I did find a nice piano cover of the theme. It had too many views, so too many people would have known it, so I wasn't... I like niche. I like niche stuff. I like to, you know, feel like no one else knows about it. It's kind of not what we're looking for, is it really, Philip?
No, but it is kind of the music you listen to, Dwayne, so I do understand that.
Excuse me? We promised last episode that this one would be Sophie Aldred, or the next episode would be Sophie Aldred coming to join us and speak with us. But you may have noticed that this is the fifth episode we're releasing in the month of April. We've got five Thursdays, and we're always intended to only release four episodes of the Sirens of Audio a month.
That was to keep your life a bit saner, wasn't it, Dwayne, with all the work you've
been looking forward to a couple of weeks off, but... Thanks to Joe Sims, we have managed to be able to have a chat with him. He'll be coming on very shortly to talk to us about Dalek Universe. So, I thought with the recent release of Dalek Universe and the Dalek Protocol, better get Joe on, have a chat to him. And we're going to share that with you in a few minutes because there's been... The last week, we're recording in the third week of April. So, it'll be the fourth week of April or the fifth week, fifth Thursday of April when this comes out. But it was such a busy week last week, and not just for Big Finish releases as well, because we had the Lone Centurion come out, and then around the same time, an episode of Primary Sources came out, which is an offshoot of the Doctor Who show. The Doctor Who show boys put out Primary Sources. Did you hear that episode with a familiar voice on there, Philip?
I did. Now, whose voice was that? That was so familiar.
That was me.
Yeah, I know.
So, I'm going to put a link in the show notes to that episode of Primary Sources. 20-minute episodes from the Doctor Who show.
You recorded that months ago, didn't you? I remember you talking about doing that a long time ago.
2 months. 2 months ago, I recorded that one with Rob. Then, the Dalek Protocol was released. The Fourth Doctor, Leela, John Leeson as K-9. That came out. And then another podcast came out. That's the one that I recorded 6 months ago, All of Time and Space, talking about The Rescue with Mark and Ian from that podcast. So, that came out as well. And then Dalek Universe came out. So, boy, it was a hectic week for the old headphones. They got a bit of a workout last week. So, I thought we'd better grab Joe, have a chat to him about Dalek Universe and talk about all these releases that came out. So, first of all, The Lone Centurion. I'm not going to recommend that today. I'm going to recommend it in the future. But I'll just quickly say, if you haven't heard it, if you're skeptical about it, don't worry. Get it. Listen to it. You'll love it. Because I think you loved it too, didn't you, Philip?
I did. It's a fantastic, fantastic story. Three very... Yeah, the tone of it all. You'll just keep smiling. It's just a lovely, lovely three stories.
And the next release for that week, Dalek Protocol, give us your thoughts on that one.
I love Tom Baker, love Louise Jamison, and having Jane Slavin come back as Anya Kingdom was just wonderful. They went to a lot of effort to keep Jane not meeting, Anya not meeting the Doctor because of what's happened in the past, which I thought maybe they overstressed more than they needed to, but it did work. It's a great four episodes. It's a follow on from Death to the Daleks, and there's a couple of episodes on Exelon, but then it actually moves into another location, which I think actually kept the story pumping along. Because I at first thought it was just going to be two episodes, to be honest, and then they did a couple of twists to actually make it work really well for four, and they did some great character work. So yeah, the new character of 7-Eleven, Mark 7, who we met, with River Song last month, or was it the month before? When was the River Song release? Whenever that was, we met Mark 7 there.
I think that was in January, actually.
Oh, really? Where's this year going?
Yeah.
So anyhow, he's a great character. We've got to talk to Joe in a moment. But just the way that Joe and Jane and Tom bounce off each other, and then, of course, he did David Tennant. It's just some great character work happening between those actors. So, yeah, really enjoyed it a lot more than I expected to. And I didn't understand what the title's about when it came about. I thought, that's excellent. What did you think?
I thought it was fantastic. I listened to it again today, and I got more out of it. And I really do love it. I love it. I love Death of the Daleks. Probably on par there with Day of the Daleks. I'm not quite such a fan of Planet of the Daleks, but this is a sequel to Death to the Daleks. It's sort of not a direct... It's a sequel to a few different things. So it's a sequel to Death of the Daleks, sequel to Daleks Master Plan. It's a sequel in a way to the Syndicate Master Plan, because it's post Anya Kingdom for her, but it's also a prequel for the Fourth Doctor, and it's a prequel to Dalek Universe. So because we're establishing the characters that we're going to have moving forward in that box set, so the only, and it's got Bilal in it. So how can you go wrong with Bilal? It's one of the characters that we know Nick Briggs loves in that particular era of Doctor Who, and for him to be able to play Bilal would have been fantastic for it.
Yeah, I tweeted to Nick during the week about the fact that he really was in heaven. He got to write a sequel to Death of the Daleks. He got to play Bilal, playing the Daleks. It was really all his little dreams coming true in this one story.
The only niggle would possibly be the fact that Nick plays about four different roles in this character. So he plays Bilal, he plays the Daleks, he also has another major role as one of the human characters, but he's also doing various voices that pop up over the comms as well, and you can tell that's Nick's voice too. So this would have been one of the stories that they did in lockdown quite early. So getting cast members together may have been an issue. So Nick may have had to stand in and do a couple more voices than he normally would have done.
It'd be budgets, I'd say.
It's a noticeable aspect of this particular story. It detracts a little from the production for me, but it doesn't detract from the story. I'll put it that way. The story is fine. It's perfect. Go with it for the story.
I don't agree with you, but I know what you're saying.
Why don't you agree with me?
I don't hear Nick Briggs in the Daleks at all, and I don't hear him in. I didn't hear him in Bilal, so certainly the other main character, I could hear Nick Briggs in, but I thought that the other characters were so different it didn't really matter.
Okay.
So yeah, I was happy enough to have the roles, and as I said, I think Big Finish has to always be looking at their budgets, and they've always got to be looking at who they're employing and what they can do in terms of making things epic. And to have Nick, who's a talented actor, playing a couple of different roles, and I thought that they were distinct enough to get away with.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, well, I think you're wrong, but that's okay. We're allowed to be different.
Exactly.
That's fine. I still love you. This is how it's done, fans. This is how you disagree and still get on.
I'm going to tweet something really nasty about your mother next, though.
Oh, yeah, you will too. You wait till you see what I reply. Now, The next day after Dalek Protocol came out, the podcast episode of All of Time and Space was released with me talking with the boys about the rescue. And I must say right now that I was not responsible for the decision that they made to name that episode, that particular name. And it's all David Whittaker's fault and perhaps William Russell's fault as well. But if you want to know why I had to say that, you're going to have to go to All of Time and Space and check out that latest episode. So, the day after that...
Can I say, I thought you kept them more positive than usual. One of the things is that sometimes they can be a bit negative, those boys, and I thought you actually kept them really positive. So, well done, Dwayne. Your positive nature came out.
I don't mind Ian's... Like, you may be talking about Ian when it comes to the negativity, but I like Ian's negativity because he expresses it in humour, which always gives me a chuckle. So, I don't mind... that kind of negativity. When negativity comes from a place of hate and that kind of place, I don't like it so much. But, yeah, negativity shrouded in humour, I can cope with a lot better. Okay, so Dalek Universe was released. And let me tell you, now, I've said a few times how much of a... not a 10th Doctor fan I am, haven't I, Philip?
You have said that.
Well, after Dalek Universe, you can throw that out the door. I'm back, baby. This has brought me right back. This is just David Tennant as the 10th Doctor perfection. You talk about it, Philip, because I'm very speechless when it comes to his performance in this.
Yeah, I think the thing that I enjoyed the most about the performance was I think David Tennant has found his voice the best he's had it. I do actually think that when he came back to the role, he didn't quite get the accent right, and he was emphasizing some things in some of the other earlier plays, not quite how I thought he should have done it. I think he found his perfect voice again in terms of the TV voice. I think part of what's made it so successful for him, though, is in terms of working with Joe and working with Jane. So these are three closely connected actors. So Jane Slavin, and I don't know how much Jane and David have done together. I know they've done some things. But Joe, and of course Joe Sims and David Tennant are good friends that have worked together in Broadchurch. Jane and Joe have worked together as well. And so the three of them just carry the show like heroes. And three very differently drawn characters. They all are very, very different. But the way they actually interrelate and play just makes the characters fascinating. And then throw in, I mean, the John Dorney first two stories by John Dorney are astounding. Hmm. I mean, you've probably seen on Twitter, no spoilers, but yeah, it's a cliffhanger that is just amazing. And you know, when we had John on earlier on this program, he talked about the fact he'd written a cliffhanger, which was astounding, and we heard it. And it was, and I did spend half of the next episode trying to work out what the heck is going on because it didn't seem right. But David Tennant plays everything just to perfection. And then there's another great one with Mechanoids for the third show. So, yeah. So have you got your speech back now for David?
Yeah, that's my favourite episode of the three, the Andrew Smith one.
Yeah.
There was just something about that was really good. Don't forget, Mark Gatiss is in there too. So, there is a lot of questions forming in my mind, particularly after the cliffhanger. I thought, how is this going to be resolved? And I thought, oh, yeah, they can resolve it this way and this way and this way. But it didn't happen. John Dorney, of course, goes and resolves it this way, a completely different avenue to where I was expecting it to go. Mark Gatiss is not there as prominently as I would have expected, but... that's not to say that he won't be back. And we also, you know, I've got thinking in my mind, well, hang on, is Mark Gatiss's character related to other characters that he's played recently in the Doctor Who universe? I don't know. We'll see. So, yeah, lots of questions forming in my mind, and I just cannot wait for the next installment. Well, how long have we got to wait? Another couple of months? July, it's coming out, so... really, really looking forward to it. It's the release of the year so far, and that's shocking for me because it's a 10th Doctor story, and I'm saying this is the release of the year so far. Everything I've said about David Tennant in the past on this show, throw it out the door because, yeah, I take it all back. take it all back. It's just brilliant. So, we've talked a little bit about the releases for this month, but I do have a little rabbit hole. Because there were so many releases, I wasn't going to take us down the rabbit hole, but here it is. So, let's go. Beep, beep. Okay, so this is a rabbit hole that is partly your fault, Philip.
Everything's my fault, Dwayne.
It relates to the Big Finish podcast from this last weekend. Now, have you heard it yet?
Yes.
Now, I wrote an email to Big Finish.
You got slammed.
I wrote an email to Big Finish. Nick read it out, and he had a little dig at me. So, I'm going to address that little dig right now, and it's all your fault, Philip, because what it was I was asking for the speed changer to be included into the Android app, because you tell me that it's on the Apple app, and with so many audiobooks coming out, then perhaps I could listen to them at a faster speed on the Android app, because I did notice recently when we reviewed, what was the book that we reviewed? The James Goss book. It was the Douglas Adams one, The Cricket Men. I listened to that over 9 hours and you listened to it over 6 hours, and that 3 hours could have been very special to me. So I thought, yeah, that's a good idea. However, Nick decided to play my email, his reading of my email at 1.5 speed the whole way, and you could hardly understand what was being said anyway.
Can I just say, I was listening to the podcast at this point at 1.5, and so I had to slow my podcast back down to 1 so I could hear it.
And he got to the end and he said, I don't really think I agree with that, because I think it's a little bit disrespectful to put it on a faster speed. And I was thinking about that, and I thought, well, maybe he's got a point. Maybe he's got a point, because one of the audiobooks, or enhanced, they call them enhanced audiobooks now, is Terror of the Master. Now, I can't imagine listening to that at 1.5 speed, because there was music, there was sound effects, there was lots of post-production. It wasn't just someone reading a book.
No, it's good at 1.5, Dwayne. Trust me.
You did it, did you?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, that's terrible.
So, actually, I did it at 1.25.
Yeah. Well, 1.25 you can get away with, but I mean, Terror of the Master wasn't that long. It was only, 3.5 hours, as opposed to The Cricket Men, which was 9 hours. So, not like your standard. They're not as long as a normal audiobook reading. But they also got more post-production on them. So, in some ways, I think Nick may have a point. I don't think it's disrespectful. I think how you choose to listen to anything is up to you. But I do hear what he's saying, in that you may not fully appreciate all the work that's got into it if you're playing it at that different speed, just like you could hardly hear my email that he was reading out at 1.5. So, and it got me thinking, too, of Colin Baker. I remember hearing him once years ago saying in an interview somewhere, I can't remember where now, that he said he never gets up at the cinema and leaves the theatre while the credits are rolling. He will sit there and sit through the entire credits right to the end. And I went and watched a movie in Hobart, actually, because that was the only place it was playing. And we went down to Hobart and watched this movie, and I watched the credits right to the end. I was thinking of Colin Baker saying that, and I was thinking, am I respecting the credits? But there was something special about the movie, that because it was involved a lot of Indigenous Australians and everything, so there was music going that I was really tuning into, and I was kind of reading all the credits as much as I can as to who was being, which elders were being paid tribute to in the credits and things like that. So, in some ways, I was paying respect by sitting there watching the credits, but at the same time, I don't think it's disrespectful to get up and walk out at the start of the credits either. Give us your thoughts on that, because you're the one that got me into this speeding up things, Philip. And so, I'm the one that got ripped into. Well, it wasn't ripping into. It was just I had a little dig at.
Yes. Well, two things. Well, firstly, I always stay to the end of the credits. I always like seeing who's involved, what's involved, seeing how large the different departments are. So I do always stay. I love the music, and sometimes there's a reward. So I took my son to see Tom and Jerry the other day, and got to the very end of the credits, and there was a little 30-second scene at the end, and there was me and him and one other person left in the theatre. Everyone else had left, and so we all got a special scene because we hung on to the end. So, yeah, so I do that. In terms of... I wouldn't actually speak to someone who creates audios and say, I want to listen to their stuff faster. I might choose to do that, but I wouldn't actually send them an email and say, oh, you should put this function on.
But what if I wanted to listen to something like, say, the John Nathan Turner memoirs or the Nick Courtney book?
Yeah.
That's not really a story. It's more of an interview type thing. And I might want to listen to that 3-hour thing in 2 hours. What's the problem with that?
Yeah, no, I agree.
I would never, ever do it to a full cast audio or even a companion chronicle or something like that. But and even one of these enhanced audio books, I don't think I could do it because there's music in it, like I said, and the post-production's quite heavy. So
and you have to focus more if you do it. So yeah, if I'm listening to something faster, I do actually have to be more focused on the fact that it's happening faster. So I do think he took a little bit of offense more than he needed to, but I think maybe he was just joking. I don't know.
I don't think he took offense, but I think he took the opportunity to have a little dig.
And let's face it, Dwayne, whenever we can have a dig at you, it's worthwhile. So
Yes, it is.
So next time, check your emails before you send them.
Send them to you first for vetting.
Exactly. And then I can make fun of you instead.
All right, we'll get out of this rabbit hole now. I'll put in a trailer here for Dalek Universe, and then we'll come back with Joe Sims.
Anya! Anya!
From Big Finish Productions, Doctor Who, The Tenth Doctor Adventures, Dalek Universe 1.
Time travel. Good idea or not?
It's overrated. Anya!
Bit dark though, isn't it? Surely if you're going around opening doors, you'd switch on the lights.
Maybe those systems were damaged in the crash?
Very probably.
Mark! Wait, Mark? Mark, I know! Mark 7? But why send me there? Why do you two?
I believe I may have the answer to that conundrum. I think you may have been sent to me because I was investigating George Sheldrake.
And he's launching the time tunnels from there at midnight.
Midnight? Why is it always the end of the world at midnight?
You can trust me. In fact, that's your only option. I'm the foremost temporal scientist of this era.
Don't thank me yet. I think we're coming down in the clearance zone. Among all those mechanoids, brace yourselves!
Ah, too late. They've opened fire. Ah! It's landing in the next street. Then let's get over there. You too, mechanoid. Come on.
Mechanoid.
The Visians. There's one in here. Whatever potential chronoclasm this is, it's likely to have been triggered by the activation of the time tunnels.
Temporal anomaly detected!
Big Finish. We love stories.
You're the only one that can help. Without you, it's the end of everything.
One of the most anticipated Big Finish releases of 2021 is Dalek Universe, featuring David Tennant as the 10th Doctor. As well as the return of Anya Kingdom, played by Jane Slavin, another character created by Terry Nation for an unmade 1966 American Dalek series, the android Mark 7, is here in this set as one of the main cast. Now, in that 1966 pilot episode called The Destroyers, when Big Finish made it, Mark 7 is described as handsome in the most classical sense. His features and physique are perfect, one in the mould of Adonis, Dorian Gray and the Greek gods. A sculptor asked to produce the ideal male would design Mark 7. So, who else could be cast in the role of male perfection such as this? It's none other than Joe Sims, and he joins us now on the Sirens of Audio. Thanks for dropping by, Joe.
Hey, it's an absolute pleasure, and what a fantastic intro that is. That's why you've asked me to come on and do a video, so people can see in Technicolor that I fall very short of that mark. This is the beauty of audio. As an actor, you're able to kind of transform yourself. So like, you know, I can be an Adonis. I can't do that on TV. I can't be the epitome of male perfection on TV or film, but on radio, I can do it. I could have a voice that could potentially lend myself to exactly that. And that, for me, is the absolute beauty of working in that medium. So, yeah, it's brilliant. And I get to change my voices and become all kinds of different people. And, yeah, I'm very, very lucky and very fortunate to be able to do what I do.
Actually, Joe, for those of us in Australia, can you tell us where you come from in England and why you have the accent you have?
Yeah, of course. I'm from the southwest of England, in a place called Bristol, which is, I don't know if it's got the same association in Australia, but yeah, it's certainly, we're seen as quite agricultural folk around our way. So I've got the voice of a traditional English farmer.
It always makes me think of the Goodies, where they the Goodies would do that accent, and they'd be chewing on pieces of hay with their straw hats on, very friendly. You know, so the perception is very friendly, easygoing, get on with everyone, help their neighbours. Is that the kind of people?
Yeah, definitely. We're seen as a very kind of friendly and very likable bunch, I think. But I think the kind of misconception is, or maybe the correct perception is, we're not the sharpest bears in the zoo. In fact, I think that even in the West Country, we kind of buy into that a little bit ourselves. There was a bloke, an amazing intellect called Professor Pillinger. I don't know if you know him, and he launched a probe that was headed for Mars. And when you hear the accent, you're like, oh, that's not getting past Swindon, that. If he sounds like us, I mean, he's a very lovely man, I'm sure. But I don't know if people of our accents are expected to launch probes that can get to Mars.
Have you noticed the attention that's coming towards you now through joining this Doctor Who universe?
Do you know what? What it didn't surprise me, I suppose, because I've worked with David before. But it's such an amazing family to be part of, the Doctor Who family. And I guess I kind of anticipated it a little bit, but like the most pleasing thing for me is that you've all taken Mark Seven and myself into your hearts. And I'm deeply, deeply grateful for that, because I think the BS detector among the Whovian community is such that you don't suffer fools gladly. So if you don't like what's going on, then you're very vociferous in your condemnation of that, because you're purists and you love what you love. And so I'm really, really grateful that people have been really kind. And David, like, you know, David kind of anticipated that and was like, if you put the work in, then people will love you for that. And I didn't take that lightly. And we did a lot of work, a lot of character work, in order to be able to when we finally got to record Mark Seven, we got to hit the ground running.
Awesome. So tell us a bit about how you got into acting in the first place.
I was really lucky that I think that, irrespective of what you do for a living, I think that, yeah, you might meet that wonderful teacher. I guess have you guys got a teacher that you're kind of grateful for?
Yeah, yes.
Got all of you. Yeah. God, let's say their names. It's nice to say their names, isn't it?
Mine's called Owen Chadwick. He was a music teacher, inspired me in terms of music.
I don't know what my teacher's first name was. It was Mr. Tom from grade four. He used to say some really wise things that stick in my mind, and I still bring them to mind even now. How long ago was that? 40 years ago.
but it's incredible. The sad thing, I think, for teachers is they don't get thanked, because it's not until we get to the ages that we are now where we're able then to, like, you know, we would like to be able to reach out and thank them for all the work they did in our formative years. So it can often be quite a thankless profession, because at the time, you know, kids by their very nature are quite selfish, I think. And by the time you get to kind of, you want to thank them retrospectively, it's difficult to keep, to be able to get in touch with them. So mine was called Mandy Langston. She put me on a path to when I was 15 years old, knowing what it was that I wanted to do for a living. And also for a kid, like a working class kid from a council estate as well, to let me know that it was a viable profession. You know, there wasn't, like, you know, in the area that I grew up in, talent was everywhere, but opportunity wasn't. And I still think that's the case. And that's the case for, I don't know if that's the case in Australia, but that was the case for so many people here in the UK even still. So I'm very grateful to a teacher like Mandy to be the unstoppable force to my immovable object, or the other way around.
And so what kind of encouragement did you get? How were you steered in that direction?
Well, it was like an open audition for a drama. Me and my, it was raining at the time, and so we weren't going to play football. And so me and my friend went to the drama block and like auditioned for this play. And I don't know, we were pretending to be in a car or whatever, and there was a car crash and doing whatever was really exciting for an 11-year-old boy at the time, or a 12-year-old boy at the time. And then I got cast in a small part in the play. About a young Superman. I didn't play the young Superman. I was just one of the people in the background. But it was intoxicating, like, you know, to be able to walk out on a stage and to entertain people and to hear people laughing when you spoke, and you could feel that atmosphere was palpable in the air. It just felt so amazing. I was like a drug almost. And that was a bit of me. I was sold right there and then, and never looked back. Is a wonderful thing to be able to play different people and explore different characters for a living. And there's been ups and downs, and I've not been lucky enough to be able to pay the mortgage through doing it up until about 10 years ago. But I've always been an actor, but you've always had like lots of different side hustles and all those kind of things. Like, you'd be working full time and then learning your lines when you got home, and then doing some fringe theatre and all that kind of thing. And just keep banging on doors, really. I suppose I'm not the most talented person in the world, but I am one of the most relentless.
I suppose you've got to be that way. Did you do some study on scholarship in San Francisco?
Yeah, I was really lucky. So I left school when I was 16 and then went to work in the post room for a local TV station, then was a runner, then got to be a researcher. And then we all got made redundant because some big changes were happening. And I got something called accredited prior learning, which meant that I got, even though I didn't get any kind of GCSEs, I got enough qualifications through the work I was doing to be able to do a part-time course to get me to go to university. And then I went to university to study drama because obviously that was my big passion. But again, never thought anybody on my estate would be going to university. It wasn't really kind of pushed at school. And then on the second year, American universities run their theatre departments like a repertory theatre. So it's done for profit, essentially. And so they have a list of plays that they want to do for that season, and they cast accordingly. And so they're offering scholarships in these amazing universities for people that could fulfill the criteria for those roles. And fortunately, I was in the right place at the right time, and then spent a year out in San Francisco, which was just incredible. You guys have been, right?
Yeah, it's my favorite city in the States. Not that I've been to many, but you know, I'd go to San Francisco over New York, for instance, although I love New York as well. But I love the vibe there, because I'm actually based in Tasmania. So, and the capital of Tasmania, Hobart, is like a small version of San Francisco. So it almost felt like home. Any places that stand out in your mind from San Fran? Because I was only there last year, just before everything locked down. So yeah, I've got good memories of that city.
I got to say, like, you know, Haight Ashbury for me just felt lovely because, like, you know, I am a big Grateful Dead fan. So to kind of walk that walk and to see where, like, you know, I loved Haight Ashbury. I loved Berkeley, even though that wasn't where I studied, but they called it the People's Republic of Berkeley. And I got to sit in on lectures, and I'm quite a chatterbox, but I was so in awe of these people that, like, you know, I was just kind of just forced into silence, just listening to, like, you know, these wonderful orators and some of the finest kind of, I suppose, lefty minds in the world, you know, just doing battle and just explaining things and painting pictures in your mind. And I just had such an incredible experience because for me, like, you know, it felt like the home of a movement that, like, you know, that I feel like I'm particularly close to. And so, like, you know, sort of, politically and socially and stuff, I feel like, you know, I felt like I found my tribe over there, and just got on with the people, just really, like, you know, very kind of people that understood the, like, you know, the need for a community, I suppose, and civic responsibility and community spirit. And I just found that was lovely. Everyone went the extra mile, and I don't know what it's like in Australia, but in the UK, you go, yeah, if ever you're in, like, you know, if you're ever in Bristol or whatever, come and look me up. And I do generally mean that for most people, but sometimes you're like, oh, it's a bit of a pain in the bum. But when you meet these people in America and they go, oh, yeah, like, you know, if ever you're in Sacramento, come and look me up. They genuinely mean it. They can't wait to show you around. And it kind of inspired me to be a little bit more like that, you know, just a little bit more kind of open and appreciative because, I don't know, there's that wonderful phrase in The Departed, you know, the film The Departed?
Hmm.
Where he says, life's short, act accordingly. And that feels like a wonderful mantra to live your life by. And also just don't be a dick. Like, you know, like why aren't we trying harder to be nicer to each other? You know, be a bit more kind of supportive. You know, the time we get to spend here is finite. So it's nice to be nice, I think. And I felt like I learned a lot about that in my time in San Francisco.
Whenever I spend time in the States, they struggle to understand the Australian accent. How did you go with your regional accent? Were they okay with that?
I wish I could say that I wore it proudly, but I was a single man that succumbed to kind of adopting a Hugh Grant-esque posh accent and tooting it around quite loudly. I remember getting to the first time we were having a meeting with all the people on a drama course. And I was talking to a couple of people, and these beautiful girls walked in and just went, "Oh, who's the smart guy doing the British accent?" And I said, "It's me." And she went, "It's not very good." Then all of a sudden, our professor walked in and said, "And Joe Sims is going to be joining us for the year, all the way from London." And then their jaws dropped, and they were like, "Say something in British. Say something in British." And I thought, "Oh, do you know what? I kept up the Hugh Grant accent all the way through." And so I'm really sorry to the people of Bristol because I'm not the proudest Bristolian in the world. But yeah, for that year, I dropped it.
The most common nationality I was mistaken for when I was in the States was Irish, and I have no idea why that is the case, because they're not similar accents at all.
It's so strange, isn't it? I don't know why. I guess it's just because people's ears aren't attuned, and so they assume that if it isn't kind of Hugh Grant-esque English, like even me, like, you know, my Bristolian accent was like, are you Irish or are you Australian? Because they've got, I guess when you watch TV in the States, really, you're either a Cockney or you speak with received pronunciation. I feel like that happens, like, you know, that happens quite often. You don't really hear the broad range of regional accents that we got here in the UK. I love the UK for that, because you only have to go 20 miles and someone sounds completely different. But I don't think that those people really get as much airtime maybe around the world. So Cockney and RP seems to be the ones that people recognise the most.
Do you feel that's changing? Are accents becoming more acceptable across the whole arts industry? Because certainly, I mean, the BBC has always, you know, traditionally always been RP, and only recently we started to see more accents coming in. How have you found as an actor trying to get work, and how much do you have to change? I mean, David Tennant had to go English to do to get the Doctor Who role, and that's not that. You know, I guess it's getting long ago now, but I mean, it's sad he couldn't use his Scottish. Do you find that it's a hindrance for your work?
I agree. I mean, you know, the thing is, I think for like voiceovers and stuff like that, sometimes it can be, because they know that if they know you're Bristolian, then especially for kind of commercials and things like that, they'll go and get, if they want a Scottish person, they'll get a Scottish person. They won't get like a someone who can do a Scottish accent or a Birmingham accent or a Liverpudlian accent or something like that. And, you know, part of the reason that we work so hard to be able to, like, you know, to play different roles and all those kind of things and do all that legwork is so we can, like, you know, we're actors, like, you know, like, yeah. I think you're right. I think it's changing. I think you're hearing a lot more working class voices, so you're hearing a lot more working class accents. Jodie, for example, is the case in point of that. You know, she's got a Huddersfield accent and she wears it really proudly and really, really well. So I think that maybe David just got caught in a time where that decision now, I just think it would 100% be different.
Yeah. So just changing topic slightly, 2009, what's that, nearly 13 years ago now, you were making a couple of films in Indonesia, is that right?
Yeah, what an amazing experience that was. I mean, I guess it's on your doorstep, because we saw so many Aussies and so many Kiwis when we were over there filming, because we started off, we had like fight training, weapons training and all that kind of thing, because it was a film about Indonesian independence from the Dutch. And I played this the head of a torture facility called Sergeant de Graaf so he was a Dutchman. And so we had to have weapons training, fight training, and we were in Java for that. So I was in Jakarta. And then when principal filming took place, we flew out to Bali and just got flown in wherever we needed to be whenever we were filming. So oftentimes we would be off for about a week or two and just left to our own devices, exploring Bali and then, like, you know, flying out to Borneo or Flores or something like that, or go to the Gili Islands. And it was just, I mean, it felt like paradise on earth. I feel like, if I'm honest, my friend always laughs at me because he's like, whenever you come on like a podcast or something like that, he was like, you just sound like a competition winner. And that's absolutely the way I feel. I feel really, really lucky that people are kind enough to employ me to do this for a living. And I hope it continues forever. But if it was to run out or my luck was to run out, then I feel like I've had an amazing ride. And living in Bali for 6 months arguably was like, you know, me at my luckiest, because there was like a compound, like, I couldn't believe it. There was like a compound in Bali where we had a butler that just looked after the four places where the actors lived. And we had our own swimming pool and we could have parties and things like that. And we could see in gym. Have you been to Bali?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Yep.
We were in Jimbarambe, and so we could see the fishermen coming in, and we all had motorbikes. So we could see them from where we were because we were quite high up. And then we would jump down every night, jump on the motorbikes and drive down to the bay. And there was these little warungs, really tiny warungs and stuff. And you could just pick what you wanted to eat, like red snapper or lobster, and just have a couple of bintangs and watch the sun go down. And I'm yet to find a better experience anywhere on earth than watching the sun go down in Jimbarambe, eating completely fresh fish and having a couple of bintangs, watching the sunset. All for the princely sum of, I don't know, like 15 English pounds for this incredibly decadent dinner. It was one of these things. I always feel like, for me, I want to, like, I try to teach myself to kind of appreciate living in the moment. And that's the most difficult thing in the world. If any listeners know how to do it, then please let me know, because I'm still, you know, I'm still learning. But that was one of those moments where, you know, I just had bruises up and down my arms because I was just pinching myself because I couldn't believe how lucky I was to be there.
There's a restaurant in the bay there where me and a group of friends, we went and all the dinner was served. So we picked our lobsters, they cooked them in the restaurant, and then we were all eating on the beach on tables. And the tide came up and, you know, lapping our feet and then lapping our knees, and we just didn't care. We just stayed there. We were waist deep in water, drinking bean tongues, eating fresh lobster. It's a great night.
those are the days you live for, aren't they? Like, you know, you remember those forever. Forever. It's just an assault of the senses, visually, you know, olfactorily, like every single bit of you is absolutely tingling because I just felt really, really lucky. So yeah. But I was a proper nasty piece of work in that film as well. So I was driving around in, like, you know, Jeeps, pulling teeth out of people's heads with pliers and stuff. He was I think when you're 6'3" and a bit unfortunate looking with a skinhead, then I think you're often going to be playing those baddies. So I get to play those guys on TV and film. But I think it's cathartic. You get to purge your demons on stage and on set and go home and be nice to your nan. It's all those good. It's all them good looking boys. They're the people you have to watch out for. They're probably horrible in real life.
And one of your earliest awards that you got was a People's Favourite Male Performance in a play called As We Forgive Them. And that that part that you played sounded really interesting. Tell us about that.
Oh, it's amazing. It was a writer called Richard Brigette, and he'd written this three-part drama. And one was, and all it is a two-hander. So there's only two people in it. It's myself. I played a guy called Lee Fenton, who was convicted for the murder of a congressman's daughter. And so the first one was Barack Obama's inauguration. And then it was this, and then 4 years later, his subsequent re-election, and then Democrats losing to the Republicans 4 years after that. And he goes from being this kind of feral, barely sentient human being who's angry at the world. And the senator kind of teaches him how to read, teaches him how to articulate his feelings and stuff like that. And as he grows, as he grows in substance, I suppose, and becomes more articulate and becomes more more able to, like, you know, to be able to connect with people, arguably he becomes even more dangerous. It was an amazing character to play, and the twist at the end is just incredible. But what it taught me, I think, more than anything, when you're playing somebody that's a convicted killer, which I've had to do a few times subsequent to that, is it sounds horrible, but you've got to find a way to humanize that person and to be your own hero within that story. Things that you and I might find morally abhorrent, and they are morally abhorrent, in some way you need to dig deep and try and find what would motivate that person to behave in such a way, and to behave in such a way that they can justify that behavior to themselves. Because there aren't many people that are kind of mustache twizzling evil. Like, all these people feel like they're doing something for a justifiable reason, and that can be quite dark, the kind of rehearsal process in trying to really kind of mine like quite deeply why that person would behave in such a way, and to convince yourself or to convince that character that they're their own hero on that journey.
Because no person believes they're a villain, do they? No matter how bad they are, they feel like they're justified in accepting it. How do you, as an actor, what's your... You obviously sound like you have a very big process in terms of a belief in the characters you're playing. What is your process in getting into a character?
I just believe in, like, in 100% honesty. You know, swing big and miss is okay. Like, I've basically stunk out every rehearsal room in the country, you know, by making some really bad choices. But, you know, you trust in everybody. Like, you know, say for Big Finish, we're surrounded by exceptional human beings that, like, you know, that know those worlds inside out, and they're fans, you know. And so because of that, you've got so many people that you can lean on and you can talk to, and you know that if you're making a misstep, then there's something that can be discussed and we can talk about it, and everyone can kind of, like, you know, talk quite candidly and open about their feelings. I just feel like if you're gonna do this for a living, then you've got to be 100%, because people, like, you know, people can smell BS a mile away. And I always say that to young people when I'm, like, you know, if I'm going into drama school or anything like that, then strong in wrong is a much better way to go. If you believe in what you're saying, then the audience is way more likely to forgive it if there is a misstep somewhere along the way. You know, say for example, if you're doing a character who's playing Mancunian, you're doing a Manchester accent and it goes a little bit Liverpool. Well, that's okay. There are some people that live between Manchester and Liverpool, but you can't make any apologies in your voice. If you're making apologies for your character, it means that you don't believe it. And if I don't believe what I'm saying to you, then how can I have the audacity to expect any member of the audience to believe what I'm doing? And so that's why I think that if you do that solid prep work, you do that groundwork, then I think that it always yields positive results, because you go in there completely confident that you know what you're doing and very comfortable that you know what you're doing, and you live and die by those decisions. That doesn't always mean that you're right, but it means that you feel like you've discharged your responsibilities as an actor to your audience as best as you can.
You've done a lot of radio as well. You worked on The Archers, long-term radio show, and lots of other radio work. When you look at TV, theatre, radio, is there a particular style of acting that you prefer?
I love radio. I love working in that. Because actually, you know what? We're all bound by one thing, and that's the imagination of the audience. If you've got a fertile imagination, that is a wonderful breeding ground to be able to, like, you know, to be able to create worlds that, like, millions and millions and millions of pounds is not going to arrest that shortfall. Like, there's no way. Like, I was hearing about how much they spend on Lord of the Rings. Did you read about that?
500 million, the new series. It's $650 million for the first season.
£650 million for, or dollars for the first season.
Yeah.
And you know what? that's still not going to be as good, I don't think, as the worlds that you can create in your mind. Say, like, you know, it, like, you know, when the script sings and you know those characters better than you know yourself, and your mind's just whizzing off in all those kind of directions, and you're in a darker room, and you're listening to your favorite favorite radio drama or audio drama, then I don't think you'll get anywhere near it. £650 million is not as good as your imagination, because it's somebody else's. It's somebody else's thing, like, you know, all these audio dramas, they're different to everybody. In that same way as they always ask you the question, like, you know, is your red different to my red? Almost definitely. I can't describe to you what my red looks like. But those worlds mean something different to everybody that listens. And I just think that that's just an amazing way to work.
I think audio helps too. If you're a 6'3" skinhead, you can go into those other roles and do any other thing that you might not normally get if you were cast in a TV series.
It's so true. Like, I've been able to play, like, you know, so many different people, that I could only dream of playing. Like, I wouldn't have a chance. I played the world's most expensive footballer or soccer player. There's no way. If you throw a ball at my feet and film that, you would know very quickly. You would give 2 pence to me rather than £60 million, you know? So that was an amazing opportunity. It was great. I think probably, like, and the thing is as well, I think it's really important for directors and producers to be able to foster an environment where actors can feel creatively brave. You know, you do your best work when you can be afforded the right to make mistakes. You know, you don't hit a coconut every time. Sometimes it's a swing and a miss. But if you're not allowed to, like, you know, to make a swing and a miss, then you're never going to be able to do all the brilliant things that come out. Like, you know, the truly great radio dramas and audio dramas, I think come about because you're in a wonderfully creative environment, a very nurturing environment where you have got the right to fail. I did a thing for the BBC. It was called Lifelines, which I still absolutely love. And I got to play a boxer. He was a boxer journeyman. He was just there to kind of turn up to let better boxers kind of beat him up, I suppose, and just carry on going up the ranks. And and he was a Bristolian guy, and he just had a newborn. And at the time, I just had a newborn. He just lost his wife to cancer. And he's holding his baby, and he stood on the edge of the suspension bridge in Bristol, and he's ringing the police, at, like, you know, 999, saying that he's going to jump. It was the most. I got goosebumps when I'm talking about it now. I cried when I read it. I cried when I did it, and I cried when I heard it. Like, I mean, it was just some incendiary radio. It was just incredible. And again, it's testament to great writing. It's testament to great directing, and to creating that wonderful kind of, you know, cocoon of safety where you can feel creatively brave to be able to do that. Because if you've got one, you're as strong as your weakest link. If there's one person sneering at you, like, you know, then you feel that you can't be as brave as you want to be. And then that just kind of, like, that tempers everybody's performance. And so, it was an amazing experience. And I'm really grateful for that. Similarly, the Big Finish guys are exactly that. It's fantastic writing as well. Like, you know, having John in the room when you're working is brilliant, because if you have any questions, because there's things that get thrown up when you're doing it. There's things that get thrown up when you're reading it. And there's things that get thrown up while you're performing it, and you're in situ and you're like, oh, I want another go at that, but I've got questions about that. And you've got the whole team that are around you to support you, to make sure that, you know, that everything that you're doing, you know, feels right, feels authentic, feels just. You know, and that's amazing. You don't really get that in telly. You don't really get that. Like, the writer's not going to be there on set every day. So it's a real privilege, and I feel like it bears out in the work.
Yeah. You were talking about swinging and missing. Well, you swung once and really hit big time with Broadchurch a few years back. And I was looking at an episode of that when I knew I was going to be speaking with you. I just looked at the first episode. It's a pretty massive canvas, at the big cast. Were you able to get to know each other pretty well on set? Is that talk to us about what that was like.
Well, I've got to say, first, it's my big break. Like, I'd never done anything that big before. So to be the regular in a TV series is really, really daunting, especially when you knew what the cast list was going to be. Like, I knew all those people, but I didn't know those people personally. I just knew them because they were in that black box in the corner of my living room. You know, I see them all the time. But the only person I did know was DT, because we'd done Romeo and Juliet together for BBC. And he was brilliant and I loved him and we got on great. And what luck, because when I walked in that room, palms sweating, really, really nervous. And he came out of his way to get hold of me and introduce me to every single person, everyone in the cast. And I'm sat there and she's going, oh, hello, I'm Olivia Colman. I'm like, I know who you are. I know who you all are. but you can't say that. You've got to go, oh, be really professional. Lovely to meet you. And I'm so grateful to him for doing that, because he just made a really nerve-wracking experience, just a really, really lovely one. And yeah, we did become like an amazing family as a result of that. You can't help but do it, because we were portraying a town that fell in on itself because of the murder of a young boy, where everyone was suspects. And Chris Chibnall did a beautiful job, I think, of not telling anybody who did it. So all the way through, up until we got the last two episodes, we were just hypothesizing about who could have done it and why. And then when we're playing these scenes up until episode 7, I suppose, genuinely, no one knew. No one knew who the killer was. We had to put little stickers in the makeup truck as to who the fool did it. And I think everybody thought probably it was going to be either me or Will Meller, the guy who plays the psychic.
I thought it was you.
Even the old man thought it was me.
Can I ask? There's thousands of hours of television made every year, and yet there's only a very few programs go through history and get huge reception. Now, Broadchurch is one of those standout productions that just took the country, took the world by storm, continues to be talked about. In the rehearsal room, did you think it was going to be as big as it was?
No, I suppose not. I mean, you could never, you could never anticipate something being taken into the hearts of certainly the British public and then beyond in the way that it was. Like, it sold to 150 different places worldwide, people really took it to their hearts. And no, you couldn't anticipate that. I think, you know what though, at the same time, as good as it was, because it was absolutely brilliant, there is a massive slice of luck that comes with those kind of things. Sometimes things just just hit the right ear at the right time, or everything comes together. When those stars align, then amazing things happen. It got released at the same time as another show. I can't remember what the other show was called on the BBC, but it was a real flagship show for the BBC as well. And they were going toe to toe. And this other show I watched many years later and thought it was actually really good. But it just didn't, for whatever reason, Broadchurch captured the heart of the people. And then we just all enjoyed that kind of incredible success. And that was the first time I'd ever met anybody in real life that was, that was kind of adored in the way that David was and is, just see legions of fans and stuff come down to West Bay, exactly where you're standing at this moment. Yeah, that's it, the cliffs. And just be so, so lovely. Armies of people just coming down there and giving him presents and spending time and talking to him and having a photo with him, all that kind of thing. I mean, it was amazing. And he's never taken that for granted. He's always really, really lovely with everybody, and justifiably so. He can't believe his luck. It's brilliant that he's been he's so revered, and justifiably so, because he's as lovely a bloke as he is talented an actor. So he deserves all his success. And we were just a really, really nice gang. We go out drinking together, eating together, socializing together, going on beautiful walks out in the West Country. It was great. It was a brilliant time. We would be fishing with the driving boys as well. There were teams of drivers that were doing mackerel fishing off the coast, and then having a bit of a barbecue. So it's nice. Cast and crew all got together for a brilliant summer.
Did you have many issues in terms of public reaction? Because, I mean, your character was awful. and you played him so well. Do you find that people struggle with understanding the difference between an actor and a character they're playing?
100%. I mean, some of the things that get said on me on Twitter, and they're like you know, you big bold minger, if you because I threaten a dog with a crossbow in the show,
yeah.
And they're like, you big bold minger, if you touch a hair on that dog's head, I'll kill you. I'm like, you do realise that, like, I mean, that no dog is ever going to be hurt in the making of that show. That was actually Pauline Quirk's dog in real life. She went like, you know, I'm holding a crossbow to a cameraman, so chances are a cameraman could have got hurt, but when it does the reverse, there isn't a crossbow being pointed at Vince's head, you know, like that's never going to happen. And the big bold minger thing, that's just me, that's the way I look. That isn't a character thing, that is just my face, I'm afraid. So it's a bit mean. My mum got a bit angry. But on the penultimate episode, right, I'm walking to the petrol station to get some milk for me cornflakes one morning, and this police car pulls over, and she was like, the police lady got out, and she was like, did you kill that dog? And I've looked at her, and, you know, my mind's in a muddle. It's like 7 o'clock in the morning. I was like, what are you on about? She was like, in Broadchurch, she killed that dog. I was like, oh my goodness. A real-life police person asks you if you killed a dog. I'm like, oh, no, I'm getting held up on some fake dog napping charge or something. And then I was like, oh, right, yeah, the TV. No, I don't know. And then you're like, should I tell her? Am I obligated to tell the police lady the truth? Do I have to give her the skinny? Do I have to tell her who killed Danny Latimer because she's a because she's a copper? I don't know. But, yeah, that was nice. But the worst thing is, can I say who the perpetrator actually was in Broadchurch? Everyone's watching now, aren't they?
Yeah, bad luck.
Okay. So when they find out that it's Matt Gravel's character, Joe, I rang him because I went down to the paper shop, and he was on the front page of maybe 3 or 4 different papers in the UK, and that's amazing. When, like, you know, life, like, you know, like art's bleeding into life, like, that's an amazing thing. And I rang him. I was like, dude, you're on the front cover of about 4, like, you know, like national newspapers today. I was like, you might want to stay at home. He went, I got to do the school run. I was like, send them in a taxi. Like, no one wants some child killer turning up at the school gates today. You're a public enemy number one.
Now, I know at the time that was being filmed, Nick Briggs lived close by. Is that where you met Nick, or did you do some work with him prior to Big Finish?
No. I'd never met him until we'd first worked together on a Big Finish production, and so he was like, you know, he was someone that that Chris Chibnall would talk fondly about, and I didn't realise that he lived so close because he's in Bridport as well. So yeah, it would have been nice to have seen him and to kick off our friendship earlier, but alas, it wasn't to be. I didn't get to meet him until many years later.
In terms of Doctor Who, how much? I think you're a little bit younger than Philip and I, so you'd probably be of that generation when Doctor Who wasn't on the television. So how much do you know about the show, or how much did you know about the show before you came into it with Big Finish?
Sylvester McCoy was my first Doctor Who, and I remember really fancying Ace. I'm sure I wasn't alone, but I used to think that Sophie was absolutely gorgeous, and so yeah, the psychic circus was like, you know, was the thing that used to have me kind of hiding behind the TV, but Sophie Aldred's character Ace would get me to poke out behind the cushions and stuff and feel a little bit braver, because yeah, she made me very happy, but I was probably about 9 or 10 at the time, so I didn't know what to do with that. But she just thought she was, like, absolutely lovely. And, you know, and it's one of those things, then you're kind of bitten by the bug. But then there was that hiatus for such a long time, and it was a real shame. So I'm so pleased to come back, because it was woven so intrinsically into the fabric of, like, you know, my father. And just as I was starting to, like, you know, to get bitten by the bug, it was cruelly taken away from us. So, like, you know, I feel really, like, you know, feel very happy for the youth of today to get it back.
You haven't emailed Chris Chibnall and said, where's my job?
Do you know what? I have done that. I have 100%. Like, when we last spoke, I text him every now and again. I'm just like, listen. I was like, Mark 7, what do you reckon? What do you think? can we get him on? Can we get him on the telly? And he's promised me that he was like, when the role comes up, when the right role comes up, then he's gonna try and get me in. So watch this space, because I would absolutely love it.
Awesome.
Because the thing is, as well, just like Big Finish, you know, Chris is an absolute unapologetic lifelong fan, and I love that. I love that, and I love that he gets the chance to be able to do that for a living, because you know that is like it's bucket list stuff, isn't it? The thing that you love from when you were a child, and then just be able to get to kind of you know shape these wonderful characters and stuff, and you must just feel like you know like you're in heaven. That comes with massive responsibility, of course, and not everybody is always going to agree that you're right, and everybody's got their own they've all got their own views and stuff. But yeah, that is an opportunity that, that you couldn't possibly let pass.
So you've done a few Big Finish audios prior to Dalek Universe. How would you rate the quality of Big Finish's writing?
I think it's excellent. I mean, you know, the thing is, like I said before, you know, when you're working, with these brilliant people, they love it. They absolutely love it. They eat, sleep, and breathe it. So, like, you know, what you've got is access to an almost encyclopedic knowledge of the worlds in which you're inhabiting. Like, you know, so there's no point in trying to bullshit it. Ask your questions. Don't ever be scared to feel stupid, because they're such a nurturing bunch and a lovely bunch. And, you know, my subject knowledge is nowhere near as good as, like, you know, as all these wonderful people. So, like, I ask all those questions, and they always say, like, don't be afraid to ask a stupid question, because we've asked them all. And I think that's lovely. Again, it goes back to working in that nurturing environment where you just have some fun. It's a bit of a shame that we didn't get to do this one in studio, because it's like, you know, because it's just such a lovely bunch of people, and you want, like, it's better when we're all together and having a laugh together and having our lunch together and having our tea breaks together and just telling stories and stuff like that. So that was a bit of a shame not to do it together, but that's not to say that we won't all be reunited in the future.
How did you come to work for Big Finish?
I don't know, to be honest with you. Like, you know, it was always a company. There was always a company that I wanted to work for, and I was in the the RDC, the Radio Drama Company for BBC for a year, and I was lucky enough to have to got nominated for a couple of awards and things like that. And so there's a lovely lady called Tracy that I think was working with Big Finish and BBC as well. And she's an incredible actor, and I think that she might have thrown my name into the mix. And so again, it was lucky enough, like right place, right time, and then I got on with everybody. Because I think the nice thing about Big Finish as well is you never ever meet anybody that you don't get along with. Everyone's lovely, and that's not true of TV at all. Like, there's always going to be, like, you know, well, not always, but, like, you know, there's sometimes you kind of rub shoulders with the occasional wrong one, and that's disappointing. But a Big Finish, that never ever happens. And I'm not just saying that. Like, I mean, it is just that I just think that people do it for the love of doing it, and because of that, it bears out in the work that they do and the kind of people they are. And so, yeah, we just have a really nice time. Plus, I bet you've had this a lot. The lunches are absolutely out of this world. The food is incredible. You've never had a bad lunch at Big Finish. It's worth it.
Describe it
for
me. Describe the meals that you get.
It is a veritable smorgasbord of home cooked loveliness. There's pies, there's pastas, there's quiches that we all make there. Like, loads and loads of cakes. I mean, you start off, if you're there for like 2 weeks, by the end you have to butter the door frames to get yourself in and out, because you've had so much cake, you've definitely put on a bite of sting. And so when you're saying Mark 7 was the the epitome of masculine loveliness or whatever she said, well, he definitely wouldn't have been if he was having big cake, Big Finish lunches every day. It is just so sublime. And you know that, I feel like that bloke in Monty Python where he was like, oh, go on, just have another mint. It's just wafer thin. I feel like I'm going to explode, but it's totally worth it. Totally worth it. Gorgeous.
What we do know about you, obviously, is the fact that you must be a super nice guy. The way we know this is because you can look at the history of Big Finish, and in terms of companions, the fact that you did a number of stories first and then they brought you back as a companion means that they really like you and you're really nice. Because it's like Jane Slave and India Fisher. There's all these cast members that they do a couple of shows with, and they work out, we love these people so much, we've got to bring them back as a regular. So the fact they've done it with you means you must be a super nice person to work with.
That is a very lovely thing to say. And the feeling's definitely more than mutual, because like I say, you don't meet any bad ones in Big Finish HQ. So it's great. And also, like, you know, Jane is someone that I was lucky enough to work with at a BBC prior to working with a Big Finish. So we're already big mates, and, like, you know, just kind of continued on that track. I defy anybody that meets Jane Slavin and not to love her, because she is just one of the world's better people.
What's your impression of Tom Baker?
An absolute legend. You know, but again, like, you know, this is somebody that for me is like, you know, he burns through, like, you know, sort of Britain like a stick of rock. He's one of the people you put up there. Like, he's so kind of, it feels like so essentially kind of British. And those stories he tells are just amazing. You just get to sit there with one of those homemade slices of Big Finish cake and a cup of tea and just listen to Tom Baker tell stories all day, every day. I mean, I've probably been there, I've worked with Tom maybe three times, and I reckon all three times he's told me variations of the same story, and it never gets boring because he always puts a different spin on it. It's always really exciting. And I'm like, he's just... His raconteurial prowess is peerless. I don't know anybody that can spin a yarn like Tom Baker. Just absolutely extraordinary.
You have no idea what the truth is now at all, do you?
Oh, no idea. But you don't even care. I don't care. Like, I mean, if he took some of my stories and made them their own, they'd sound so much better in his mouth than they would do in mine. So just have it as his own memories. Let him run with it. Whatever he says, I'm just in complete thrall of. So, yeah. I hope we get to work together again very soon, because he's lovely.
So you got to work in studio with him, is that right?
Yeah.
Because you did a couple of his specific stories, like, because Dalek Protocol was a Mark 7 one that was released this week. Was that in studio or was that during lockdown?
That was during lockdown, unfortunately. So I had to make my own lunches for that, which are nowhere near as good. So in lockdown, I guess everybody works doing voiceovers and things like that had to come to terms quite quickly with being able to get their own studio set up and stuff to be able to work remotely. So that's what we did, and I think that's amazing. I mean, like, especially from Big Finish as well, like, you know, the amount of work that they were able to do in a very short space of time by learning this new technology, embracing this new technology, and then trying to get everybody au fait with that technology is no mean feat. And they did it effortlessly and they did it brilliantly. Because I am I feel like I'm like an analog man in a digital world. So for me to be able to wrap my head around the tech, if I can do it, literally anybody can do it. And it was nice. It was so lovely that we all knew one another, though, because I think that working remotely is harder. It is harder, like, you know, because you need to listen to make sure that you know everybody's voices and stuff. And if there's new actors coming on that you didn't know before and two people sound quite similar, it's difficult to, like, you know, it's difficult to kind of piece it all together. But also that comes with a lot of responsibility. And I found that on Broadchurch and things like that as well, I think that if you're regulars on a show, then you don't want to be cliquey. You want to be, you know, you want to be as open as possible. So if people are coming on to do one day here or 2 days there, you want them to have the experience that you're having, like, the amazing time that you're having. And I feel like people like Jane, DT, like, you know, David, John, Nick, like everybody like that is just so good and so mindful of that, and create that kind of environment where you always just have like a brilliant, brilliant day. And so that's the way that we kind of marched on, making everybody feel part of it and everybody feel included. And again, that's how you can kind of create your best work and also have the nicest time.
So how do you get yourself into the zone for getting into that acting day?
I've got this Chinese medicine that I use to like to kind of to clear my throat out and to like, you know, to kind of lubricate my throat, especially with Big Finish stuff. There's a lot of a lot of high octane work, so you're doing a lot of shouting and moving and all that kind of thing. But also it's just going over the script again, making sure that you're aware of your notes, like, you know, when all those kind of moments come. But also not being so kind of rigid, not wedded to the way that you feel that you're going to read it, because in that moment, it needs to feel honest, authentic and real, you know? So there's things that you do that you're like, oh, wow, that's not the way that I read it at all in my head. You know, you feel like you prepare as best you can, but I think you need to be malleable enough to be able to roll with the punches, because, you know, when you're working with wonderful actors like, you know, sort of Jane and David and stuff like that, then there's lots of different kind of surprises and stuff that you never anticipated, and more layers to the onion that you're peeling as you go along. And I think that's what makes it so good as well, because it feels authentic, because it is. Like, sometimes, even though you know the words are coming, you don't necessarily know what's coming next, which keeps it really fresh. And but in terms of preparation and stuff like that, I'll definitely be like, you know, you hit your mute button and you do, like, you know, you do your work to be able, especially because, because the accent's so different and the voice is so different, it's important for me to be able to kind of get my mouth framed it properly to make sure that I'm not just slipping before I'm playing Mark.
So do you know how you got the role of Mark Seven? How did that come about? And also then, how did you decide the accent and where you're going to take him to?
Well, the accent where I'm taking to came through discussion with John and David and Nick, where we were all, like, you know, talking together, because, you know, I wanted to get everybody's, like, you know, take on it, because they know the world's way more in detail than me, and way more authentically than me. And so because of that, it was really important to be able to get everyone's gauge. And I feel like after you've spoken to everybody, you've got an idea of how they're going to sound and stuff, and then you just play with it until something kind of sits nice in your mouth, and it feels right and it feels authentic. And obviously the more scripts you get given as well, you get to dig around in the backstory. You've got fandom, which is, like, you know, which is amazing, like a treasure trove of incredible information. So there's pictures, there's so much that you can kind of, like, you know, draw from, and some things that you're dismissive of, some things that you're utterly embracing of and stuff like that. And there's no way of being right. It's an objective, like, it's a subjective decision. It has to be something that feels right, I guess, for me ultimately. And so there might be people listening and just goes, oh, I don't know, like, I would have done it this way or would have done that way. And that's completely, like, that's completely justifiable. Like, you know, when you're creating a character, it isn't going to be something for everybody, but it had to be something that I felt was authentic to what I knew Mark Seven to be. And obviously having people like David and John and Nick and stuff like that to, like, you know, to bang ideas up against, legitimizes it, I suppose, in my own mind. I feel like if I was going too far wrong, they would collaboratively be able to pull me back in the right direction.
So who was it that wanted you to do the role? Do you know how you got the job?
I get on with them all, and I think, what did I play? I was in the Paternoster gang with Kat Stewart, who's a good friend of mine. And I think that was the last Big Finish job that I did prior to that. I think that was right. I'm not in terms of release necessarily, but in terms of when I was last in studio. And again, just had a brilliant time with everybody. And then David kind of tipped me off about it. David Richardson tipped me off about it, and I was absolutely just so excited, because that's bucket list stuff, like getting to play characters like that and to be DT's companion as well. To think that last time we worked together, he was grilling me for the murder of a 11-year-old boy and to now know that we're going to be going through Ty's face together, it's just it was amazing. It was so good. And then, like, every little bit of it after, like, you know, recording it was amazing. Then all of a sudden seeing the artwork that was coming out. I mean, that artwork is amazing. Today, I've been to the framers to get a load of the artwork framed to put up in my house, because I can't believe it. It just looks so, so good. I'm like, that's me. So, yeah, so that's going up all over my house.
In the extras, Nick Briggs actually says that he was talking with David about David Richardson about the character. And he says, oh, I just want someone who's nice and who'd be lovely to work with. And David suggested your name and Nick just said, yes, immediately yes. So, there was no one else under consideration. It was always you, Joe.
Oh, wow. I mean, that's praise indeed because, like I say, the feeling is more than mutual. Those boys are absolutely brilliant and just enjoy spending time in their company. Well, I suppose when you think about it, like, life's too short to, like, you know, to be spending time with people that you don't really want to hang around with. So even if there might have been someone that might have been marginally better, but they would have just been, I don't know, a bit of a knobhead in the studio and stuff, I think it would have been instantly dismissed. So, no, I'm really pleased about that because I follow these boys to the ends of the earth. We have such a nice time together. It's great.
So what was the first script that you did for Mark 7? Because, I mean, you've done all the David Tennant ones. You've done the Dark Predator with Tom Baker. You did the River Song, Queen of the Mechanoids. Do you know which one you... Which was the first time you got to play Mark 7?
It was Tom's first. I think it was Tom's first. Like, it was Tom's first. It all feels such a long time ago. The idea of being in a studio with other human beings and stuff just feels crazy. Like, you know, now we're so kind of... institutionalized by lockdown because I was looking at pictures prior to coming on air where I've just got a picture of me hugging Tom and just thinking, oh, I can't wait to do that again. I'm just give him a big squeeze because and that was the first time I think we got to hear from Mark 7, so that was great.
It was interesting. There's a little bit of a spoiler, maybe, but the Dalek Protocol, of course, is actually named after you, and I sort of think he did. How great to actually have a title of an entire story based on your character, what's going on in your life.
Everything about this story, I can't say anything. I feel like I'm going to get Dalek Protocol Tourette's and say something that I shouldn't. And I've not felt that since I was going on like live TV and talking about Broadchurch and things. And like, you know, there's so many things that you can't say, but there's reasons that we can't say it. It's so nice when it all comes out and it all unfolds. As we find out, with the amazing twists that, again, we're not allowed to talk about because people have not heard it yet. But there's one twist in particular which is just mind blowing, and there's definitely a lot more in this special sauce. There's a few more twists and turns before the end, and I can't wait for you all to hear it because it is incredible. So it's amazing, isn't it? Like, it's kind of named after you, but there's so many amazing things in here as well that I can't wait for everybody to be able to listen to it and start unpicking it and then talking about it and bringing Twitter to its knees as it did last week.
Yes, I mean, I messaged John Jawney to say I could understand he's a wicked evil man with that cliffhanger. And I'm sure, and we actually had him on the program, and he told us about the fact that he'd written a cliffhanger, which he was just waiting for everyone to hear. And he couldn't tell us what it was. And of course, as soon as I listened to that episode last week, I went, this is the episode he was alluding to, because it's such a wicked, awful cliffhanger. But it's brilliant.
Isn't it? I mean, like, you know, we were a little bit lucky, I suppose, that, like, you know, when we got it, we're going to be recording in succession, so you know what I'm making sure that I am not saying anything.
Go too far.
But you know what's happening next, anyway. So, you know, it's one of those things where you just that I think is when you know you're onto something special. You know, when you're reading the script and you can't wait to, like, you know, to turn the page and just go, well, what's next? What's this? What's next? And if you haven't got the next episode, you're like, you know, you're on the blower to David. It's just gone, go on, send me the next one. It's not finished yet. Okay, but I've got a few questions then. Tell me this, tell me that. Like, you know, I mean, I feel like, you know, we're all fans in that direction. And when the writing's so good, like, you know, you just can't wait to hear what happens next. And I think that's gonna bear out in the listening to it as well.
Did you actually get to record with Alex Kingston?
Yeah, I was not in the room. No, we did that remotely as well, which is a shame because I've never actually met her in the flesh. She's one of the few people that I've not had the privilege to have met. But you know, I'm sure she's absolutely as lovely as she was meeting her digitally. But it'd be lovely to meet her in the flesh. But yeah,
she's in America at the moment, isn't she?
She's
isn't she based in America?
Oh, yeah, maybe that's it then. Yeah, the budget's not big enough to get me flown out to the States. For some reason, I thought she was in the UK, but I think that maybe because I heard that there was someone else in the room that had a British accent. I just assumed if two people had a British accent, that they'd be in Britain. But, like, of course, we can be anywhere in the world in a minute, can't we?
Absolutely. So outside of Big Finish, because there's probably not much you can tell us about what's happening in Big Finish, but are you doing anything else that's coming up shortly?
Yeah, we're. I'm writing something at the moment. There's an amazing story in Bristol, which is kind of woven into the fabric of Bristolian folklore. I don't know if you've heard it. I don't know if it's got to be interesting to know whether you guys in Australia have heard it. But this man worked at Bristol Zoo car park, and he was taking £5 for cars and £10 for buses. And he did it for 25 years. Then he just disappeared off the face of the earth. And the zoo rang the council and said, you have to send someone in because Danny's not here today. And they're like, it's your car park. You know, we got nothing to do with it. So Danny was telling the zoo that he worked for the council, telling the council he worked for the zoo and taking all the money in cash for 25 years. And then bang, he went like Kaiser Soze. So we've written a story about this this guy. And it's just been picked up by a production company who made The Inbetweeners. I don't know if you guys have seen The Inbetweeners. So it's Fudge Park. They've just picked it up, and so we're developing that at the moment. So I'm going to be playing the zoo car park attendant.
It's a wonderful job. It's a wonderful story because, I mean, my understanding is he never missed a day of work, and no matter what the weather was like, he was out there faithful, and everyone just thought he was the best person ever.
In as much as anything can be a victimless crime, I must have given that man, I don't know, at least 50 quid in all my times going to the zoo, but I don't begrudge it not one bit. I just think it's just such a beautiful crime. Everyone's happy for him. So, so I'm looking forward to, like, you know, so we're writing that at the moment, and I'm looking forward to be able to share that with the world because, you know, he's a lovely character. It's a nice comedy, and he's got a heart of gold. So, hopefully that one next.
So you're collaborating or writing that on your own?
No, I'm working with two other Bristolian writers, Paul Holbrook and Amy Travascus, and we're working on it together. And it's so much fun because, again, they say that if you do something you love, you don't work a day in your life. And I feel like that, like, you know, the idea of, you know, just hanging out with mates and just, like, you know, telling silly stories and writing funny scripts and stuff like that just feels like, I don't know, just feels like an absolute pleasure. And the idea of getting paid to do it, just, like, you know, it feels criminal, really.
Well, thank you so much for spending so much time with us and talking about your passion for acting and the parts that you're playing in the Doctor Who universe. It's fantastic to be able to talk with you. Thanks, Joe.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much for having me on.
Captain, might I advise an immediate long-range sweep on the external detectors?
What's that?
Oh, no.
Dalek ships at extreme range. An attack force, closing fast.
And we're sitting ducks. From Big Finish Productions, Doctor Who, The Fourth Doctor Adventures, Dalek Universe, The Dalek Protocol.
There, Leela. You see that little screen on the console?
I see it.
It lists all previously visited destinations alphabetically. So why not make your choice?
Exelon.
Exelon is downright deadly.
Technology destroyed Exelon once. A blasphemy against our great god, the city.
Yes. Oh, it's you, Seven. What do you want?
I've accumulated evidence to suggest a low but significant chance of an enemy incursion on this planet. I request a detachment of Marines for an investigation of the outlying area.
What evidence?
What is that sound?
It's a beacon.
Channeling power back to the Exelon city.
If there is to be a war, then let it come. You really seek a war with the humans?
They are here only to take from us.
Just as the Daleks did all those years ago.
Master.
Okay, Nine, what is wrong?
Leela, watch out for that spear!
Do not worry,
the chip is poisonous!
Obey the Dalek Protocol! Victory is assured! Victory! Victory! Victory!
Big Finish. We love stories.
What about these new prisoners?
the Doctor and Leela.
How do you know them?
That's going to be interesting.
So that was the trailer for The Dalek Protocol. Can highly recommend you grab a copy of that. And it's been a pleasure to speak with Joe Sims. I'm sure you agree, Philip. And I might go... No, I won't go first. It might be your turn to go first for recommendations this week.
My turn first? Okay. Mm. If it's my turn, I'll go then. A bit of a sad event that's happened this month, of course, that many of you realise, is that it's 10 years since the passing of Elizabeth Sladen. And I think, you know, most of us of a certain age anyhow, and anyone in fandom, just can look back on Sarah Jane Smith as a very pivotal companion. And it, for those of you who had a chance to meet Elizabeth, I had the privilege of meeting her and spending a few hours with her at one stage, and she was just the most beautiful, charming, generous person, and she just cared about fans and cared about what fans thought. So my recommendation this week is she's only actually read one audiobook. So when they first started turning the Target novels into books, she was employed and did The Planet of the Spiders, and it's the only audiobook she did, but it's actually a really great one. So I've been listening this week to her reading Planet of the Spiders. So you just, yeah, I love her voice, love how she reads, love her characterizations. If you love just the way Elizabeth, her intonations and the way she phrases words and sentences, which is quite unique for who she is, that'd be my recommendation. What about you, Dwayne?
Okay, so for this time, because we've been dealing with characters based on Terry Nation's universe, namely Mark 7, the Joe Sims version of Mark 7 is not the first time we've seen or heard Mark 7 on audio. Big Finish did an audio version of the pilot episode of a Dalek series that Terry Nation pitched to the US, and it was almost made. But never quite made. So the pilot episode didn't have a name, but Big Finish called it The Destroyers. It was adapted by John Dorney. So if you, and Nick Briggs. So if you, yeah, you're always in safe hands with an adaptation by John Dorney. But you'll find this, it's not a standalone. You have to get the Second Doctor Lost Stories box set, which includes a story called Prison in Space, which is a script that was scrapped in series 6, and I think it might have been replaced by the Crotons, I think, if memory serves me correctly.
Or the Space Pirates.
Yeah, one of the two. It was one of those troubled scripts written by a fellow called Dick Sharple. So, but Daleks the Destroyers is on that particular set. Stars Jean Marsh, so another actor, of course, playing Mark 7. But I had a listen to that today, and it's pretty good. Pretty interesting little piece. So I'd recommend that for sure, to get a copy of that.
You know, I have that set, and I've never listened to it.
I don't think I did until today either.
Yeah, I might. I'll pull it out of the... I've actually got that in hard copy. I'll have to pull that
out
of the...
Is that because you were never able to get through Prison in Space?
I think I listened to the
first... It's pretty hard to get through.
I think I listened to the first episode, and I couldn't get through more than that. And I didn't know there was anything else on there till you just mentioned it. So there you go. I'll go looking. Thank you,
Excellent.
Dwayne.
And we've been going for such a very long time stage. We're going to leave it there for this episode. We promise next time we will have Sophie Aldred joining us, and you'll be able to hear lots and lots of good stories from her about her time in the TV series, her time in audio, and some other things that she's been doing, particularly with her recent book release on audiobook as well. So that will be good. So until then, ta-da!
See you later.
You have been listening to the Sirens of Audio episode 55, Seven of Mark, with our special guest Joe Sims. Next time on the show, we promise we'll be joined by Sophie Aldred, talking about her TV, audio and writing work. Theme music by the Jackpot Golden Boys. Email us at sirensofaudio@gmail.com. Check out sirensofaudio.com for links to all our podcast and social media locations. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel and like and share our videos to your heart's content. We send you a massive thank you for that. And if audios are making you imagine you may be an Adonis or a Dorian Gray, may we suggest you avoid the mirror as we do and simply listen to another piece of high-quality audio drama, because audio drama is so cool.